الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على خاتم الأنبياء وسيد المرسلين سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. My dear brothers and sisters in Islam, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Inshallah, I'd like to delve directly into the topic. It's a very vast topic and I have to squeeze a lot in a few minutes. So I begin first with four introductory remarks. One, it has been reported a few years back by the Time magazine that the ratio of American women who embrace Islam compared to males is 4-1. That's rather amazing ratio. Marriage in itself to Muslims cannot explain the whole picture. But what is most amazing is how come more American women, and I suppose the same thing applies to Britain and other Western countries, why should more women embrace Islam if all the propaganda seems to point out that Islam is the most oppressive religion to women par excellence? I wonder whether one possible hypothesis is that some of our sisters from Jewish or Christian background, mostly from Christian background, are perhaps somewhat knowledgeable in some way or the other, or some degree or the other, of what the Bible and the history of the church held, and even rabbinical traditions concerning the treatment of women that some Muslims are not aware of. My second remark. About my interest in that topic, I remember more than 15 years ago I read a very interesting book in Arabic by Muhammad Ghunim on the same subject, and I must confess I did benefit tremendously from that book in the production of a couple of programs in Islam in Focus, or Islamic teaching. And towards the end of album 3 there is 1 hour discussion of that topic. Very recently also I have seen a very excellent article by Dr. Sharif Abdul Azim, which was actually in the internet. Some of you might have seen that. And it comes under the title Women in Islam versus Women in Judeo-Christian Tradition, The Myth and the Reality. And I found that also to be a very scholarly and very thorough job. My third remark is that because of the time limitation and the multitude of references that can be made both to the Quran and the Bible, I would skip the specific references, and I have a few copies here that some of you have already obtained, I believe, in previous meetings or occasions. It's called Woman in Islam, an Outline. Short as it may be, it is full of references, particularly to the Quran. I will not also go through laborious chapter and verse from the Bible. Some of these references are to be found on those tapes, Islamic teaching, and even more thorough references has been given by Dr. Sharif Abdul Azim, not only from the Bible, but from other literature. So I can skip that as well. Finally, the fourth introductory remark is the way I hope to be able to present the topic in this very short time, and the way I chose it is the same kind of structure I used both in this outline as well as my little book, which is called Gender Equity in Islam. I found it easier to address the topic from the spiritual, economic, social, as well as political and legal perspective. So these are the four areas I would like to highlight very quickly, inshallah. First of all, on the question of spirituality and humanity of women, I begin first with the biblical provision. The second and third chapter in the book of Genesis give some more detail about the creation of Adam and Eve, but the big differences from the Quran begins with what happened afterwards, the story of the forbidden tree. We are told in the Bible that Adam and Eve were told not to eat from the forbidden tree, and then there was the serpent that beguiled or tempted Eve to eat from the tree, and Eve in turn tempted Adam to eat from that tree. And when Allah questioned them, Adam simply shifted the blame, or passed the buck as we call it here in America, to his wife. Genesis continues that as a result of this, the punishment for women is to go through the pains of pregnancy and childbirth, and that her desire shall be for her husband, and he shall rule over her. The punishment for man is that the earth is cursed because of him, and he has to toil his living as long as he lives on this earth. Another provision we find that relates to the humanity of woman in the Old Testament is that she is described as one who is more bitter than death. It is stated that, or the writer says, I searched, I could find a good, righteous, and upright man among 1,000, but I could not find a single upright woman among all of them. Let's compare very briefly with the Quranic provision, Quran and Hadith provision in this. First of all, the Quran makes it clear that both Adam and Eve were responsible for their disobedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Especially if you read in Surah Al-A'raf, Surah 7, it uses فَأَكَلَا فَبَدَتْ لَهُمَا وَطَفِقَا, always uses the term for both of them. There is no single incident in the entire Quran that the finger is pointed towards Eve alone, as we find in the book of Genesis. On the contrary, some of the ammunition that some sisters could use, there is one ayah even that blame Adam in particular. وَعَصَى آدَمُ رَبَّهُ, Adam disobeyed his Lord. But not once do we find a parallel to Genesis blaming women for that. Number two, there is no notion whatsoever parallel to the Bible in the Quran that pregnancy and childbirth is punishment for women and is connected in any way to so-called original sin, because Muslims do not believe in original sin as a doctrine in the first place. But we find the opposite, and you find references here. In the Quran, it clearly states that pregnancy and childbirth actually are reasons to respect, adore, and honor the mother. وَوَصَّيْنَا الْإِنسَانَ بِوَلِدَيْهِ حَمَلَتْهُ أُمُّهُ. It speaks about kindness to parents in general, and then points specially to the kindness to mother because of what? Because of her difficulty in pregnancy and delivery. So there is no question. In fact, the Prophet ﷺ indicates that if a woman dies as a result of difficult childbirth, she has the highest state that any Muslim can aspire to. She is shahida, martyr. Number three, when it comes to the question of righteousness and the differing whether woman really is worse than death or more bitter than death, we find absolutely no parallel to that. The opposite is true. Surah 4 in the Quran says men and women are created from the same soul. Surah 9 describes men and women as awliya wa ba'd, supporters, helpers, allies of one another. Surah 33, Surah Al-Ahzab, it keeps repeating Muslim men and Muslim men, women, believing men and believing women. It continues repeating in every description, male and female. In other surahs in the Quran, it speaks about the reward of both men and women who are believers in accordance with their deeds, never in accordance with their gender. Moving to the second area, economic rights or economic position. Begin again with the biblical tradition. And you check references, I have that already in my programs and in the little booklet I wrote many years back. It's called The Status of Women in Islam. There are definitive and clear references to authentic sources used by Jews and Christians like Encyclopedia Biblica. There are also references to statements made by famous fathers of the church. I'm not getting into these details now because I'm focusing more on the Bible. But in any case, one can derive quite clearly that the marriage, and that's in Biblica, by the way, marriage is regarded like a purchase of woman. And what the man pays is basically a purchase price of woman. So in a sense, a wife was regarded as a possession of her husband. the property that belonged to women transferred to under the control of her husband. And that tradition continued also in Christianity. It continued even until very, very recently in Britain and other places when the Married Women Property Act for the first time gave married women the right to dispose of their own property without the control of their husband. In the book of Numbers in the Bible, in chapter 27, it's quite clear that the right of inheritance of women is really very, very inferior to men. A wife does not inherit from her husband, but the husband inherits from her. A daughter can only inherit if there is no male issue in the family. In Islam, take the 3 points. First, her property, there is nothing, of course, to start with, that a man possesses a woman or that the mahr is a purchase price. On the contrary, in the Quran, in Surah 4, in Ayah 4, mahr is described as nihla, means free gift, not to be given to the father. The father can receive it on behalf of his daughter, but it is her property, and under her control, it is a gift, not a purchase price. Secondly, all her property before marriage transfer under her full control without any word or authority of her husband or father or anyone else. Any property that she earns after marriage is entirely hers. She's not required to spend a penny even on the household. It is under her complete control. And the matter of inheritance, we find the Quran is quite clear that both men and women are entitled to inheritance, regardless whether there is a male issue or not. This might only determine shares. These are details. لِلرِّجَالِ نَصِيبٌ مَكْتَسَبُ وَلِلنِّسَاءِ نَصِيبٌ مَكْتَسَبُ نَصِيبًا مَفْرُوضًا. When it speaks even specifically about inheritance, it speaks about the rights of both male and female, that they have a specific determined share. I'm not detailing the discussion now of some of the variation in shares, which is not always the case. There are cases where men and women inherit exactly the same. Like in some cases, the mother and the father of the deceased inherit the same. Or the reason why there may be some variations, but this is far ahead of saying that women has no right of inheritance. And there are very good reasons for that, pertaining to the differences in financial obligation, which in Islam is squarely on the male. When we come to the social aspect, and more or less I'm following also the same outline, as a child, you find in the Catholic Bible, for example, some of the books that are regarded as apocrypha by the Protestants, they mention that the birth of a daughter is regarded as a loss, and a great deal of praise, a glaring praise, for the birth of a son, which in fact reminds me of the attitude of pre-Islamic pagan Arabs as described in the Quran, and I'll come to that later. Interestingly enough, in the book of Leviticus in chapter 12, it speaks about the ritual impurity of women after delivery, the postpartum bleeding. And interestingly enough, it says that if the woman is giving birth to a male, the period of purification is 33 days. If it is a female, it is twice as much. Purification becomes 66 days instead. And even at the end of that period, she has to go to the priest and make some sort of atonement. Actually, the Bible used the term atonement, as if what she did was sinful, or that's a reminder of her original sin or whatnot. But the word atonement is quite interesting also. A third observation. You move to the New Testament, for example, in the letter of Paul, the 1 Corinthians, chapter 14. He speaks about women, when they go to church, having to maintain silence, that if she has any questions, she should not speak, but wait until she gets home and ask her husband, and explicitly say it is disgraceful for women to speak in a church. Let's see the analogy in Islam. As mentioned earlier, first of all, the question of glaring praise for a male and sadness for a female, which was both among Arabs and in biblical tradition. There is nothing like that. The Quran condemned that attitude. In the Quran, you find something very interesting too. Not only it condemns that attitude, not only does it condemn female infanticide, which the Quran takes credit for stopping, but there's something very interesting. We always read that, we don't think much about it. You're all familiar with the ayah in Surah 42. لِلَّهِ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ يَخْلُقُ مَا يَشَاءُ يَهَبُ لِمَنْ يَشَاءُ إِنَاثًا وَيَهَبُ لِمَنْ يَشَاءُ الذُّكُورِ أَوْ يَزَوِّجُهُمْ ذُكْرَانًا وَإِنَاثًا وَيَجْعَلُ مَنْ يَشَاءُ عَقِيمًا. To Allah belongs the domain of heavens and earth. He creates whatever He wills. But notice here, it uses the Arabic term yahab, means bestows a gift. Bestows a gift of females to whoever he wishes, and bestows a gift of males to whoever he wishes, or give a gift of both male and female. So not only is the girl tolerated, it's also regarded in the Quran equally as a gift bestowed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Secondly, the issue of ritual purification. First of all, there is no specification of time in Islam. There is a maximum of 40 days. And if the postpartum bleeding stops before that, the woman can just take a bath and begin her regular activities, prayers, fasting, matrimonial relationship. That's one difference. The second difference, this issue of having twice as much period for a female birth does not exist in the Quran. They're both on equal footing. It's related to bleeding, not to the gender of the child that is born. But the more interesting thing is about education. What happens if a woman has to keep silent, never ask a question? How do we learn without asking questions, without raising challenges? And if it is said that she waits until she gets home to ask her husband, suppose her husband is ignorant. Suppose she is in a dispute with her husband and he's a party to a dispute. What kind of answer is he going to give to her? Is that really conducive to learning? In Islamic tradition, first of all, we find the Prophet ﷺ indicates that seeking knowledge is not only a right, responsibility of every Muslim, which means male and female, generic term that he used. We find evidence in the Quran of asking and challenging, even, not challenging in a negative sense, trying to find out reasons and arguing the point with no less than the Prophet ﷺ himself, outside of the masjid and inside of the masjid. Outside of the masjid, as you find in Surah 58, Surah Al-Mujadila, when a man used one of the pre-Islamic cruel practices by telling his wife, you know, you're to me like the back of my mother, which was regarded as tantamount to divorce, to be in a suspended state. And the woman goes to the Prophet ﷺ and argues with him. And he tells her, be patient. And she argues her point. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala responds and revealing a correction to that situation in the Quran itself. In numerous ahadith, we have examples of Muslim women asking the Prophet ﷺ in the masjid in front of men. They were not intimidated. In some cases, the Prophet ﷺ would be speaking and a woman would comment even. And we know, even though some people might say this story has some weakness in terms of narration, but nobody said it's false. We find a woman in non-religious issue, non-purely religious issue, at the time of Umar, challenges Umar in a legal matter in the masjid, and Umar has to retract and say the woman is right and Umar is wrong. Nobody told her, wait until you go home and ask your husband. As an adult woman, the most amazing thing in the Bible, in the book of Leviticus, in chapter 15 in particular, is the way a woman treated during her cycle, during her menses. Anything that she sits on or lie on is regarded as impure and contagious. In a way, if you use the term contagious, it's almost like contagious. Because it says, if a man sits where she sat, or sits on the bed where she lied down, he has to go and wash his clothing and also bathe himself. No wonder we find some Jewish women used to call the period as a curse. In some practices in the past, they used to be banished and not to be dealt with during that period because of this fear of pollution by even touching them or touching a place where they sat. In Islam, we all know it, and I'll be very brief on that, that when the woman is in her period, everything is normal. You touch her, if she's your wife, you kiss her, you embrace her, you eat with her, you sit where she sat. The only thing that's forbidden is matrimonial relationship, sexual intercourse. That's the only restriction. But otherwise, it's totally normal. We find that the Prophet ﷺ would let his wife Aisha, you know, wash his hair during her period, sleep with her in the same bed as well. As a wife, we have seen before the notion of purchase price. We find the Quran, as was quoted by Dr. Mukhtar earlier, that the purpose of marriage in Islam, according to Surah 30, is tranquility, love, and compassion. And the Prophet ﷺ said, the best of you is the best of his family. When it comes to divorce, you go to the Old Testament, you find that even mere dislike of the wife is sufficient that her husband would give her a certificate of divorce. And by the way, she can never be divorced without that certificate. You find that in Deuteronomy 24. There is no reference that we know of in the Old Testament that a woman can initiate divorce herself without having to go to court. The New Testament went the other way around, the other extreme of considering a divorced woman who gets married as an adulteress. In Islam, first of all, we find that it takes a moderate approach between the two extremes. Does not encourage divorce, provide for various steps of correction when there is problem within the confines of husband and wife, the family, and if it doesn't work, finally through courts. But the most unique thing that we find, number one, that a woman in Islam may initiate divorce. She could initiate it if the isma, the right to unilateral divorce, is included in her nuptial contract, or she could also use the system of khul'a, even if there is no fault on the part of the husband. This can be take time to explain, but there is even initiation. In addition to what the Bible mentioned about having to go to court for good cause and seek the solution of marriage. Dislike of the wife itself is no good excuse. The Quran says, if you hate them, maybe you might be hating someone in whom Allah has placed so much good. And the Prophet ﷺ said, don't let a believing man hate a believing woman, means his wife. If he disliked some of her character, he should find something else to like. In Judaic tradition, a woman can be given the certificate of divorce and sent away. In Islam, even if divorce takes place, she is entitled for support during the waiting or idda period. If she's pregnant, it could go to 9 months until she delivers the baby, and he would be responsible for her. It's not just get out and take your certificate. Islam stopped, as we have seen earlier also, the practice of suspending the wife, ila, as it was called, that a person would deal with his wife. She's neither totally his wife in a sense of matrimonial relationship, nor does he divorce her. The Quran went as far even as saying that when a woman reached the term, means the end of the idda or waiting period, you should not keep them in order to hurt them. Either you live with them in kindness, that is, revoke the divorce, or you release them so that they can have the right to remarry. As a widow, Genesis 38 has been interpreted traditionally that if a man dies, his own brother should marry his wife. In other words, the wife, that the widow of the deceased, should get married to her brother-in-law. There is no mention in the Bible that her consent is necessary. The Bible even says that if that brother is young, she has to wait until he matures in order to marry her. Only if the brother, if there is no other brother, or there is one brother or more who refused to marry her, only then can she be free to marry whoever she wants. In Islam, however, we find that a widow is completely free at the end of the waiting period. Secondly, whatever sort or type of marriage in Islam, the consent of the wife is necessary condition for the validity of that marriage. One more observation. In the book of Leviticus, chapter 21 in the Bible, notice here it says the high priest is not allowed to marry three categories: a divorcee, a widow, or a prostitute. As a mother, there is no question, to be fair, that the Bible also speaks about respect of parents, including the mother, to the point that even in the book of Leviticus, in chapter 20, if a person dishonors his mother or father, he will be put to death. But I'm not aware of specific texts in the Bible, as we find in the Quran, specifying the mother in particular for special honor, respect, and love, as we have quoted earlier. In the matter of hijab, among the Jews, rabbinical tradition was that a woman should cover her hair. And believe me, I have seen it with my own eyes. I was walking, being driven actually in Toronto. We passed by the area apparently inhabited by some Hasidic Jews. From far away, and maybe my glasses were not powerful enough, I said to my brother, "MashaAllah, so many Muslim women walking in their hijab." I said, "Brother, look at the men walking beside them. They have the skull cap. These are Jewish women." And it was no different from the hijab I see of my sisters here. In the New Testament, however, in the writing of Paul in the 1 Corinthians, it's very interesting that he also speaks about women covering her hair or her head. But his rationale is quite different. He said, because man is not supposed to cover his head, because man is the glory of God. A woman must cover, because a woman is the glory of, not of God, glory of man. That's his rationale for her covering. Yet, in Islam, there's no notion of one being a glory of God, one being a glory of a human. Covering is having a different rationale in the Quran. In Surah An-Nur, Surah 24, it relates to chastity. In Surah 33, it relates to protection of women. It is really ironic, that the same Jewish woman wearing hijab like a Muslima would be respected. A Catholic nun covering her hair would be respected, and this is a sign of holiness. And a Muslim woman wearing hijab, it is only because she's oppressed and ignorant, and somebody must have held a stick to make her wear it against her will. Finally, in the political and legal aspect, in the Bible, first of all, we find that Genesis 18, when it attributes lying to Sarah, has been traditionally interpreted by Jewish scholars that the witness of women is not to be accepted. Women are not supposed to be trusted as witnesses before courts of law. Number two, in the book of Numbers, chapter 5, if a man accuses his wife of unchastity, she is subjected to a most humiliating procedure before the priest. He needs recitation of certain waters and drink her and say, if you're really an adulteress, you know, you will die. If not, nothing will happen to you. And even if she's proven to be innocent, the man simply gets scot-free out of that. It's not like in Islam when you make false accusation. Thirdly, a man who marries a virgin and then accuses her that she was not a virgin when I married her, just in the early period of marriage, would require that her parents present evidence that she was virgin when she married him. Look at the humiliation. The Bible also speaks about, you know, holding a cloth or something like that. But if the parents were unable to provide that evidence, that girl, poor girl, would be stoned to death at the doorstep of her father. What happened if the man was proven to be a liar and the parents could produce evidence that she was virgin? You know what he does? He pays a fine of 100 silver shekels, not to her, to her father. But worst of all, that he will not be able to divorce her. I.e., he accuses her in her honor, he pays only that fine, and she's still stuck with him. Fourthly, adultery is condemned in the Bible and the Quran, to start, to be fair. But interesting enough, in Deuteronomy 22 and in Leviticus chapter 20, it defines zina, or adultery, in a very strange way. It specifies that the man, if a man commits adultery with a wedded woman, with a woman who is married, both of them are to be stoned to death. Notice here, unwedded. That implies that if a man commits adultery with an unwed woman, it is not within the definition of adultery, at least for that severe punishment. Number five, in the matter of vows or pledges, according to the book of Numbers, in chapter 30 in particular, a father or husband has the right to revoke any oath or commitment made by the wife. And that's very interesting. Who can trust to make any financial or other contract with her if some male has the right to revoke it, because she doesn't have the independent right to make it? Six, the last one, and then I'll finish with the Islamic perspective very quickly. In the matter of rape, it says that if both were married, or if the woman was married, they were both stoned to death. If a man rapes a woman who is virgin, he has, number one, to pay a compensation, a fine. To whom? To her father. Number two, he's obligated to marry her. So he rapes her and marry her. Number three, he cannot divorce her. Imagine a nightmare of a woman looking at a person who raped her, which sometimes complicates her psychology, even if she gets married to a nice person, having to live with him, and she's stuck with him. Is he really being punished or even rewarded for his evil? Number two, witness. There is no ayah in the Quran that says a woman's witness is not to be accepted because women are not to be trusted, to say the least. In fact, the Quran praises both witnesses from men and women who are pious, and their witness is accepted. There is one variation, however, in the financial contract only, as far as the Quran goes, where there are some variations, but for a good reason, not because she is not to be trusted. That I explained in some detail in gender equity, and there is some quick reference to that also in this outline. It has nothing to do with this. But furthermore, as we have seen earlier, the witness of woman is exactly equated with the witness of man, according to Surah 24, in the case of a husband accusing his wife of committing adultery. And all other ayat in the Quran, aside from these two places that speak about witness, does not specify. And we have to keep in mind distinction between what the Quran says and jurisprudential interpretation. Number two, in the case of accusation of a wife, there's no humiliation, there's no demand that parents can produce any proof, as we have seen earlier, for example, the case of Mula'ana, a husband accusing his wife. He swears or give witness or testify five times that she committed adultery, or in that case, you can make by analogy, can swear or give testimony that she's not a virgin. If she, in the case of Mula'ana, accusation of adultery, testify five times that he's lying, there is no problem. And but the Quran provides a very, or the Sharia, I should say, because this is not specified in the Quran, but in Hadith we find. But it is quite practical here that how could you live with a wife that you accused her in her honor and chastity? That's why Sharia says that they should be separated. Whether she's proving guilty or whether she counteracted his witness, there is no sense of continuation. It's not that he has to get married to her, she has to live with him, always remembering his accusation in the dearest thing that she has. Zina or adultery doesn't make that distinction. It depends on whether the person is married or unmarried only insofar as the extent of punishment. But adultery or fornication are both summarized in the Arabic word zina, regardless. So it doesn't mean a man has a license. He's not defined as committing adultery simply because the girl is not married. Rape, as we all know, is a crime in Islam. It's a crime, and the person could be punished for that in a very severe way. There's no issue of raping an unwed woman, and as such, a person can get away without any punishment. I hope that you excuse me for just hitting quick points, and this is an outline of an outline of an outline I have been preparing just to meet the time demands. I apologize to the chair also for exceeding, maybe with a few, maybe 5-6 more seconds.